You're listening to PorchDrinking.com's The Porchcast, brought to you by Molly's Spirits. And now, The Porchcast.
All right, we're good. Roll that theme song, man.
All righty, everyone, and welcome to episode 74 of The Porchcast. My name is Tristan. I'm your host, joined today by our co-host, Corey David, and our producer, Bryant Vanderweerd. What's up, guys?
Yo.
How's it going? We're missing Sammy Hartman today, but she'll hopefully join us for our next episode. One little thing to catch everybody up on. We are going to actually try to up our kind of how we're doing the show a little bit more. Luckily, I just wanted to throw a big shout out to Corey David on our team, who's kind of spearheading our efforts, and we're hoping to get more episodes to you guys every other week from now on. So be on the lookout for that. Much like today's show, some of our episodes are going to be a little bit more touching on what's going on around the industry without any special guests, but we'll still have some really rad guests to join us along the way as well. We've got an exciting one coming up with Julia Herz in a couple weeks. So stay tuned for that. And welcome to episode 74 of The Porchcast. How's it going, fellas?
It's going pretty well. I just like to think that we're capable of having a fun conversation on our own. You know, guests are great, but we know a thing or two about beer and we like talking about it. So there's no reason for us to not to get together more often.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, there's a lot going on in the beer world right now. I'm going to one of my favorite beer towns tomorrow in Bend, Oregon. So I'm looking forward to being out there and just trying a bunch of things in town. I've got a couple mainstays. I'm a Boneyard sucker. So that sounded more provocative than it was going to say.
But
I have a sucker for Boneyard. That RPM is kind of a classic and one that I'll always love. So I'm excited to kind of get out of town for a few days too, and see it be in another beer scene.
Nice. Yeah. And, at this point, I feel like we all just need an excuse to socialize. So if it means we get to hang every other week, then that's pretty A-okay by me. Before we jump into it, I do want to give a shout out to our sponsors. Molly's Spirits, for all of our Denver listeners or anyone visiting Denver, explore a land of adult beverage discovery at Molly's Spirits, offering a curated selection of beers, wines, and spirits in Lakeside and Greenwood Village, Colorado. Shop over 14,000 products, including exclusive collabs and an extensive craft beer selection in-store or online for curbside pickup or delivery. Learn more at mollyspirits.com. You know, I was just over at Molly's Spirits the other day and picked up some mezcal. That's what we're drinking a lot of these days. But they also do such a tremendous job in terms of beer collabs and some really fun new releases. So I'm going to stock up over there before the Super Bowl. I know that's coming up in a couple weeks. Hopefully you will too.
Yeah, they probably got some hop slam in right now, right?
Oh, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of those annual releases that I know it's been around for a long time, but I'm just stoked every time that it comes out.
So yeah, you get it. You get excited for Hop Slam every year too?
I do. And I don't know if it's one of those where every year, I don't know if it's as good in my memory as I like to think that it is, but sure. I still always try to make, there's certain things that I think should be tradition. And that's kind of one of them. But probably stems from the fact that I used to be I'm still really great friends with this guy, Joe Turco. He used to be the Bells rep in my neck of the woods back in New York. And there was one night after a beer fest that he was like, "Hey guys, a bar that shouldn't have got a case of Hop Slam got an entire case and they're still sitting on it. Do you guys want to go help me kill the case?"
Oh, that's the best.
Really quick. Yeah. So there was just five of us just trying to destroy a case of Hop Slam in the matter of 2 hours. And it's
how about this winning lottery? I need to get rid of, if you want, like, feel like taking that off my hands.
Yeah. So I'll always have a fondness for that in my heart. And those were always the best. And you're working with like other beer industry folks and you're in the sales side of things. You're just like, "Hey guys, I got to go kill this keg really quick because my keg is on right after this one. So I really need a collective team effort here."
Well, one of my favorite memories of Hop Slam, we used to throw, you know, back when we could throw events, we always would throw two big bottle shares a year for Porch Drinking. And one of the big ones was we always do a post-holiday bottle share just to, you know, because everybody has all the holiday parties around December, January. So we usually typically wait around till around like February to throw our big kind of like holiday party where we'd invite industry friends and, you know, of course, all of our staff members and really just throw down with some really fun stuff. But one year, I think it was the first year that Bell's started kind of distributing out here more. We had a guy bring one of those little, those kind of big personal kegs.
The mini kegs.
Yeah, yeah. They had a Hop Slam one that they had shipped out from Michigan. And we were all just like, whoa, this is like the Holy Grail. I can't believe something like this would exist out here. So we were really stoked on that one.
Yeah, has the mini keg ever really taken off for anybody? Because I know locally you guys always had, like Breckenridge did their Christmas ale here, right?
I was going to say, yeah, I feel like Breckenridge, the Christmas ale was the only one that I feel like had some legs out here for a while. But I don't understand why it wouldn't be. I guess there's not many opportunities that people would just be sitting around drinking a mini keg. But like when there are gatherings of that many people, it's like super handy, right?
It seems like, if, as a younger self, I could see that being a very bro move on my part, where I just show up with a mini keg and that's just my beer for the night, and I'm just drinking out of it like a straw. That's the only time I would envision actually using one. It's just more of like a, hey guys, check what I got. I'm into craft beer now, and I just bought a mini keg because I'm much cooler than everybody else. That's like the,
you even lift bro move, right?
Yeah, and I'm just carrying two mini kegs under my arms the whole time. Like, do you see these biceps? I know it's February, but look at these guns.
Totally. Well, I think the one problem I have with those mini kegs is that they never seem to dispense well. I don't know if you ever ran into that problem, but like they'd always be like spraying off in all these different directions, and like you never actually get like a good pour out of it.
The system has to be flawless in order for drunk people to use it. Like, if you're asking intoxicated people to have to figure out pressures and an elaborate system other than just opening a bottle or a can and dumping it into a glass, like, you're asking a lot out of people.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, but another one for me, which I can't really get out here, was always Trogues Nugget Nectar. That was another one that every year I loved it. And then, yeah, it started that style of beer because it's more like a hoppy amber, kind of that East Coast IPA, which is a little more malty than a West Coast. It's not as thin, but it still has a lot of more like Cascade and Citra hops and things of that nature. But that was another one that I always kind of was every year, no matter how much the industry changed and IPAs changed, that it always, I'd always be like the first one to get it.
Yeah. Well, we've got a lot to get to today. It's been kind of a crazy past few days in craft beer. And so there's definitely a lot that we want to touch on, some hot button topics. I don't know, for those who have been kind of on the pulse of what's happening in craft beer, but over the weekend, there was a huge story where a former Boulevard employee released allegations of sexism in the workplace and just really tons of inappropriate behavior that went unaddressed by the HR department. And now Boulevard Brewing is facing, rightfully so, a ton of backlash. We're going to touch on that here in a second, but also here more locally in Colorado, we had a lot of news that broke recently around Great Divide, which announced that they would be moving their operations fully away from their Rhino facility, moving all production back to Arapahoe Street, their original location. So we'll break down some of the implications of that and also some of the writings on the wall. We had Sweetwater Brewing, who recently announced that they would be coming to Colorado for full distribution. And then some breaking news earlier today, where we announced some big kind of a big changing of the guard in terms of shifting from an iconic beer industry veteran who moves from one iconic brewery to another that's kind of more on the rise. So, Corey, what do you want to touch on first? We've got lots to get to today.
Oh, buddy, do you want a sunshine and rainbows piece first, or do you want to get into the heavy?
I want to dive right in, brother. Let's get into it.
All right. So with the Boulevard piece, if people haven't seen it, it started to kind of blow up on Reddit, right? Isn't that where it initially had gotten posted?
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, hey, that's the world we live in now, right? News breaks on Reddit, Facebook, Twitter, whatever else. So the thing about it, they did release a statement, right? They released something that said, hey, we guess this is a problem.
It was the old corporate response, but I will touch on that here in a second, unless you want me to get into that a little bit now. But
please, let's ping pong.
Here's the thing. I a lot of people responded. Well, first and foremost, I want to say this. I absolutely believe 100%. I 100% believe the woman who came out on Reddit and you know, announced all of these allegations. I think that, you know, people people who are against cancel culture, I think will often be the ones who are like, well, we got to hear both sides of the story. Look, let's be honest. This is the craft beer industry. Sexism in the workplace happens all the freaking time. Like, mm-hmm. this is a rampant issue. This is something that continues to happen, and breweries aren't doing their due diligence in addressing this. And so, you know, what I've heard already numerous cases from people that I know from Boulevard who aren't comfortable going on the record as of yet, but they've said, yes, this happens. This has happened. The person in question, there's one particular person of interest that was guilty of a lot of these sexual harassment issues. And they said, yes, this is well known. And so for me, while it's unfathomable that this would continue to happen in craft beer, it's also 100% believable that it still happens in craft beer. I think where I kind of have this kind of like frustration is that at this point you're owned by Duvel Morgat. You are a international company. And if your HR department doesn't address issues like this that happens, then why do you even have an HR department to begin with? Like, this should have been tackled head on. This should have been addressed. The person should have been fired. And the fact that this is now being exposed on the internet is a problem. It continues to be a problem for the industry. And so, you know, their response, on the inverse, I will say their response, while, you know, really corporate-y and very, you know, without any luster to it, is how they have to respond in this situation. When you are a corporate entity like that, you have to respond. Otherwise, you open yourself to all sorts of legal implications that are gonna, you know, harm them further on down the line if they were to just own up to it. So it didn't surprise me that their response was as bland and lacking as it was, but it should have never even gotten to that place to begin with.
Yeah, Mike, I guess, without hearing more first, were things handled internally that one party thinks that it was handled sufficiently and then the other party does not, right? Because write-ups can happen. So anything other than, I guess what I would want to ask the masses, if you will, is like, is anything but being fired acceptable, right? So were there some measures that were being put into place where, hey, we reprimanded this person and it's noted in their file, but we didn't want to fire them? Because it is, like you mentioned, it is rampant and there's really no standard. Sometimes it's just a matter of, it depends on the company. And if they just see this sentence was uttered on company time and it's black and white, then they're like, yeah, that's an egregious offense. We have zero tolerance policy for that, even without any context at all. So while I of course believe the person and don't think this is something that should be condoned, we have to keep in mind like what kind of standards they might have already had in place. And it sounds like if it's as egregious as they thought it was, and they didn't take the proper measures to like actually weed it out, then yeah, that's on them. But there's not a lot of standards in place, unfortunately, because it is such a male-dominated industry.
Well, that's the problem. And, you know, I think that the other issue here is that, you know, from at least what I deciphered from the actual Reddit posts, and then also from what I've heard, you know, through the grapevine, this was not just an isolated incident. Right. And when that is an issue, when there are multiple people that are being, you know, raising questions or multiple people who have been victims of sexual harassment, and this has been reported multiple times, then it's an absolutely, immediately, in my opinion, a fireable offense. Like, this guy should have been gone a long time ago. And yeah. So I think that's kind of where I'm still just like a little bit in disbelief of the protocol, like you were talking about, the protocols that were allegedly in place, because there seems to be like there weren't any. And when that's a problem, you're creating a work environment that is not welcoming to, you know, not welcoming to women. It's not welcoming to people who feel violated in general. They feel like they might not have an ally in their workplace, and it's just not a good situation overall.
No, but the thing that's, this is going to take, it's going to take time for this kind of stuff to get ironed out. And unfortunately, fires like this, where there's smoke, there's fire. That's kind of where I was going with that.
Yeah.
This is one incident, right? And this is going to affect Boulevard. But until we actually hear more from other breweries that are taking this situation seriously, and they're saying, hey, we don't want something like what happened to Boulevard to happen here.
Yeah.
And they make a public statement about it. Like, it's not going to change. This stuff gets swept under the rug all the time, and it's condoned, not just from the supplier level. It's condoned all the way through the three-tier system. I mean, in sales meetings, the stuff that we used to have to listen to from brand managers, from route managers, just the stuff they would say, in, like, misogynistically, homophobic, things of that nature, that's just kind of been embedded in this boys club industry, was egregious. And you didn't really have a choice, because you'd have to worry about losing a placement or not being in favor with the brand manager, or sometimes even with suppliers. When I say suppliers, I mean brewers. It's not always easy to speak up. Like, if there's not a channel of communication where people feel like it's safe to come up and say something, then they never will, because they might be worried that they're not looked down upon, but in bad favor with their boss or some other superior. They might lose some status somehow. Like, it's not, I don't think it's as, what we want it to be is this pure system of every wrong gets righted and people feel like they have a voice to do that. And that's just not the case. And this goes down to bars too. I mean, I can't even talk to how many of my former colleagues that worked for other suppliers, or even people that worked for one of the two breweries that I worked at, this the stuff they would, like, buyers and GMs would say to a woman that they would never say to a guy.
Yeah.
In the exact same situation.
Well, I think you bring up an interesting kind of angle of it too, of, you know, when you break kind of the rules and you, when you don't follow the rules or ignore the rules, what is the implication? What is the punishment? And, you know, this has been one of many kind of black eyes in the craft beer industry over the past couple of years, in terms of big ones. And, you know, we talked about Founders. We talked about, you know, a lot of the Black Lives Matters when breweries, you know, didn't speak up or actually spoke against Black Lives Matter. You know, it brings into question kind of the role of the Brewers Association once again. And I know I hate to be the
that's
one.
That's what I was about to say, actually, is, you know, what role do the guilds play? What role, we're talking about, you know, there is no oversight. Does it fall on the guilds? Can it fall on the guilds? Or, like, you're talking about the Brewers Association to be that oversight and to kind of be that quote unquote corporate HR for the smaller breweries. I mean, obviously, you know, Boulevard likely has some higher ups, but yeah, for the smaller breweries, you know, what role do they play? So yeah, I just wanted to add that in. I'm totally thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, other than keeping Sam Adams a craft brewery, what kind of shit are they bringing to the table?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you are, you know, quote unquote, the governing body of craft beer, then you have to do some governing at some point. And, you know, I think they've done a great job with the excise tax and getting that kind of renewed. But on the end of actually holding their members accountable, they've done very little. And so, you know, we talked about whether, you know, it could be, you know, stripping breweries the opportunities of being at JBF, or, you know, revoking membership for a year or for longer until they can actually prove that they've gone through the proper channels of training and, you know, fixing kind of the internal issues that we talked about. And so that's something that I think that we're still lacking from the Brewers Association. You know, not to throw any shots, because I think that, you know, one could argue that this was done for the right reasons, but on the other end of things, Brewbound named the Brewers Association their, like, person of the year for what they did in terms of resecuring the excise tax. But I think that was a completely tone-deaf move in light of their many misses from a personnel standpoint of addressing some of the some of the issues that their members have been facing throughout the past year and beyond. So really bizarre.
Paul, like what are the breweries that don't join, you know, the Brewers Association? I think it's maybe the industry as a whole does what it can, you know, maybe grants the BA the ability to kind of be that oversight, but you know, it is a larger problem than just, oh, get, you know, let's have the BA or let's have the guilds, the state guilds be the oversight too. I mean, there are plenty of breweries out there that have no affiliation with either. So
Well, I mean, you will see that. And if you're, and again, I'm talking about this from purely a, well, now I'm talking about this purely from a business standpoint, but look, the numbers are going to be clear. Like Founders is losing a ton of business because of their lack of addressing diversity inclusion. And you're going to see the same with, I think already we're hearing that, you know, retailers in Kansas City are dropping Boulevard or at least putting them on a freeze for now. And so if you're a business owner and you're approaching this purely from a business standpoint, there's also a huge, huge reason why you should absolutely tighten up your house a little bit, because not only from, you know, just being responsible human beings, but also if you want your business to succeed, you can't play in this industry and continue to be that 1% asshole who, you know, flaunts the, or you know, turns the blind eye to the way that you should actually address diversity, inclusion, and then also sexual harassment in this situation.
Yeah, but I still believe that this isn't going to change for a while, because it's a bigger problem than just on like the supplier side, right? It does permeate throughout the three-tier system. And the only way that I think you can make meaningful change in a more timely fashion would be for some larger brewers, and hopefully maybe even some of the other ones that are in like the Duval Murkoff family, that say, hey, we don't like what happened here, so we are going to take it upon ourselves now, before this becomes a problem, or before it's brought to our attention that it's a problem, that we're doing something about it. And it is something that's important to us, because I would think that by making statements like that, more people were going to go want to work there.
Yeah.
So that whole, you don't even really have to do much. You don't have to fund any charities and just funnel money into the problem.
You just have to be an upstanding business who actually.
Yeah, but unfortunately, like in light of shit like this, you kind of got to make it seem like, hey, we take this seriously here.
Yeah.
And you feel like anybody that feels like this isn't an industry where you feel safe or you feel welcome, like we want you to know that this is the place for that. We want you, we want your opinions and your ideas, your morals, and things of that nature. That's to me, yeah, having to announce that you're a good person seems kind of shitty, but but it's a business, right?
Hey, like guys, we don't suck here. Come work for us.
Yeah.
We don't suck.
Well, all we hear, I mean, it's hard, and we will be talking about some really cool things that brewers in our community across the country are doing, including Weldworks. But they kind of are going out of their way. But this is a way of doing it without necessarily just putting money on the problem, right?
Yeah.
Like it's actually combing through your departments, looking for feedback. I mean, I've been a part of meetings, man, where they ask you for your feedback and then you give it and they just chew you out.
Yeah.
It's not, they don't actually want to hear it.
And that's apparently what happened in this situation as well. Like, you know, they reported the incident, and apparently the guy who was being reported found out about it and, you know, laid into the person, and so that's bullshit.
Common. That happens a lot. That's an old guard. This is an old guard male dominated industry, right? There's a lot of macho behavior, egotism, things of that nature. So one thing I did want to bring up before we move past the subject too far is that this seems pretty clear that it was repeated incidents from multiple people about, and it wasn't really like joking around. That's the weird thing about like some people in that, like an older generation, they think that sexual harassment is joking. You know, they come from that line of people, I don't know, that like blue collar ball busting kind of attitude.
Yeah, they come from the Budweiser scantily clad women in ads kind of generation. That's like, like that's the way beer is.
Yeah, the only place that women have in the industry is to sell more Corona, right? With like a cardboard cutout, like in a grocery store. But one thing that I do want to bring up, because this is something that has that affected me at like a previous job, was that, you know, I was reprimanded for saying something inappropriate to somebody that I didn't think was inappropriate. It wasn't sexual harassment. I was just trying to make like a joke about something to someone. And then that got reported to HR and I didn't really have a chance to say anything. And it was just one of those situations where it was like, there was no context at all. We were just like having a banter at a bar. And yeah. I thought I was like totally in bounds to like just make a joke about something because they were joking around with me. So one thing that I don't want to seem like we're just like
piling on
pure benevolence and we're not providing any nuance to this conversation.
Yeah.
Is that we do work in a very social industry.
Sure.
And a lot of times,
good point,
the lines can get blurred between, is this a work function? Is it not? Like, what can I say to this coworker that I can't say to this other coworker? Because when you're out drinking with your coworkers, they're a lot of times they're your friends, or at least you're very friendly with the people that you're hanging out with. And this again seems like it's a repeated offense, multiple instances here. But let's not get lost that like sometimes people do fuck up and they'll say something inappropriate because they're just like hanging out at a bar or something and they didn't necessarily mean anything by it. But it doesn't mean that it's okay. But we also do need to provide a path for people to say like, hey, what you did was wrong. This could be a learning opportunity. Where
100%. I do think that a lot of these situations, what we're lacking here is, you know, the offenders owning up to their mistakes. Again, sorry to keep harping on something that we've talked about, but Founders still has not officially actually apologized for what, you know, for being racist. And in this situation, while I do think that from a legal standpoint, they Boulevard needed to, you know, give the legalese speak in their response, I think as an industry, we need to start working towards apologizing when we actually fuck up. And, and in that situation, that's when I'm like, hey, look, if you're able to apologize, if you're able to own up to your mistakes, and then you're actually taking the appropriate actions to rectify the situation, then yeah, we're not going to write you off. Like, we all make mistakes, like you talked about. And in those situations, if we can learn from it, then that's the only way we can become better human beings.
Yeah, for some instances are so egregious that there's like, hey, you got to get out of here kind of instances. But then there's other times where Brick killed a guy. And the one thing that I would like to see more as well in this beer industry, multiple industries, is instead of this quick to cancel kind of reaction to things, like we discussed, it's this old guard sometimes that's just kind of still hanging on to the industry. And there are a lot of the decision makers in the industry as well. Are we doing enough to teach them about changes that are happening in culture, you know, shifts in how we treat and speak to other people,
yeah,
as opposed to just treating it like the way it's always been? Because there's no education on that, right? There's no, and there a lot of times, and if somebody gets reprimanded for something, it's just like, hey, you said some stupid shit at the bar last night, don't do it again. But just how about why? You know, just these are opportunities to learn. Maybe somebody hasn't heard certain things before. They don't know that certain words are inappropriate to say anymore. It just how to read the room a little. I mean, you can't necessarily coach that, but I would like to see more opportunities for rectifying situations, teaching moments, and allowing people to grow rather than just having them fired.
Well, I think that's an interesting point too, because, you know, I think the way that we can better move about that is, you know, to bring up the situation that you had just referenced, where you were hanging out with a coworker at a bar and you might've said something that was offensive. Like, I wish also in that incident that the person that might've felt offended by it would have been like, hey man, like, can we have a conversation about like what you just said? Because, you know, and I know those conversations are very hard, especially if some of the things, not saying your situation was the situation at hand, but like, you know, if you're in the Boulevard situation where the woman was being criticized for being pregnant by, you know, not just a coworker, but I think a supervisor, that's a very difficult situation to be like, hey man, what you said was kind of weird and not cool. But yeah, if it's just like joking around, like, yeah, like, let's try to have a conversation about it. And I do want to put that, you know, especially from, you know, if a third party witnessed the situation, like, I would love for our industry to hold each other accountable a little bit more and be willing to have just like open and honest conversations. I know that that's really difficult to have, but we got to move towards that.
Well, it takes everybody being open, right? And to your point, those sometimes can be difficult conversations to have. It's a lot easier to just type up an email to HR.
Sure. Right?
But at the same time, not everybody, we're talking about big breweries here. Not every brewery has this robust HR department, you know, that's there to essentially just protect the brewery, not necessarily the employees. And it's much easier to do that on a keyboard, but part of this, if we really do want things to change, then we all need to be teachers in certain moments, right? Or just say like, and just making somebody realize, just sidebar conversation, like, I really didn't appreciate that. And some people, they're not going to take that well, but that's their fault. Like, that's not your fault. That's kind of a them problem. You know, a lot of times people just are unaware. And I don't know if it's just more training in the workplace on inappropriate, what's appropriate or not, but maybe just more of an open discussion. Because sometimes those HR classes that they put together about racism and sexism in the workplace, they're pretty cookie cutter. And it's basically everybody just you have to check the box on this training, right? I don't know how you would do it. And each brewery needs to take ownership of this if they want to take it seriously, but allowing more open discussion about, hey, what's something that people don't like about the business or what's they don't like about the industry or things that are bothering them, and not getting riled up if you don't like what they have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's move on because I don't want to spend the entire show talking about Boulevard, even though we could. But I do want to talk about some other big news that happened around the industry. I know that you used to work over at Great Divide, right?
Hey, no, I was at Sierra and—
Oh, that's right. Actually Sammy, which unfortunately I wish that we could have Sammy on this episode and maybe she can talk a little bit more about it in future episodes, but Great Divide announced last week that they would be moving all of their packaging from their Brighton Boulevard facility, which is in Rhino in Denver, back to their original facility over at Arapahoe Street. And this is a huge move. It's not something that I think that caught most people off guard who have been paying attention, because over the past 2 years, Great Divide has actually sold off all the land surrounding their Brighton Boulevard facility. Originally, that location was meant to become kind of a brewery complex of sorts. I know that they had originally planned to have a larger tap room built on as part of future phases. They were also going to have a larger restaurant and some other buildings that were going to be part of this greater complex for Great Divide. But over the years, I think they had seen continued years of declines in sales and production. And so that kind of led to making the tough decision to have to sell off the land around their Brighton facility. And so now, as of last week, they announced that they would actually be moving all of their packaging, which was taking place at Brighton Boulevard, and moving it back to Arapahoe Street, and then eventually looking to sell that space. So when you saw that, Corey, what were your thoughts from an outsider's perspective?
Well, I've seen this happen before, and this has been happening, I want to say, for the better part of 6 to 7 years now, where you have these larger regional breweries that have been, and when I say regional, I mean you have your footprint is essentially the region, like your state, and then whatever states you kind of touch, and maybe a couple others, right? And then there's national, which is basically full distribution footprint across the country, and then you've got your locals that might not even distribute at all.
Sure.
Your regionals kind of got caught in this limbo where they weren't shiny and new and could pivot easily with coming up with new brands and new beers all the time. There was not a lot of hype around them. And then they don't have the leverage of a national brand where they can get into lots of chain distribution. So your Safeways, Costco's, any grocery chain, if you will, at a lower price point, they can compete with domestics, you know, things like Bud, Miller, Coors and whatnot. So you're not shiny and new, and you're not like a value craft either, right? So you're just kind of caught in the middle at this like higher price point, and you've been pumping out the same stuff for a long time. Yeah. And people get a little tired of it. So there's not necessarily a call to action for a consumer to go and buy that product. You know, you feel for somebody like them because they've put so much time and effort and energy into developing into the size that they are now, right? But it's just kind of a common problem across the industry. They can't turn the ship as quickly as some of the small guys. And then they just never really kind of grew like anymore, yeah. Like in terms of their portfolio. I know they've come out with new beers, but it's very telling when you have somebody that size not doing well. And then you have breweries like Wiley Roots. This is just local. These are local examples, but Wiley Roots, Westbound and Down, Weldworks, they're all in the middle of like big expansion projects.
Yeah. Right?
So that volume is literally just getting transferred from the old guard to the new guard.
Well, I got a question for you, Corey. Do you think that, and I think maybe this is my own projections, but do you think that brands like Great Divide are kind of, they need to go all in or completely scale back? Or do you feel like that there is some sort of middle ground? And I guess maybe the bigger question is, are there any regional breweries out there who are doing it the right way? Because, you know, I'm teasing this for another topic that we're going to touch on here in a second, but Avery just lost, you know, one of their iconic barrel managers in Andy Parker. We'll talk about that a little bit more, but you know, they're going through some of the same kind of problems that Great Divide is going through right now, in that they just, you know, they opened up this multi-million dollar facility and now they're kind of stuck in this regional middle ground where they're not fully national. They don't have those kind of benefits of being fully national. And so they're still trying to figure out how to pay off this multi-million dollar facility, and things are starting to not look so great.
Yeah. I'm thinking brands like Bell's come to mind. I know that I bring this brewery up all the time, but hey, I guess there's a reason. But a brand like Allagash is one that's done very well for themselves while still being kind of in that regional size.
Yeah.
And I think they kind of picked something they were really great at. I mean, and Bell's is kind of the same way. You know, they have Two Hearted and then Allagash with White, where they've really the breweries themselves are basically like riding on the coattails of those two brands, right? And then they've been able to do fun, innovative things outside of that that still kind of keep people interested.
Sure.
With Great Divide, I mean, it was Hercules IPA for a long time, right?
Yeah. And then also Yeti.
Yep.
And then, you know, I think that I for a second there, I thought that they were going to hit a revival in their Shandy release with Roadie. But mm-hmm. I think, you know, that saved them for a year or two. And I think it just kind of died back down again.
I mean, to build your entire brewery backbone on Imperial Stouts, you know, for a large footprint is tough, especially because.
And also a West Coast style IPA, if you're talking about Hercules, you know,
that one's real malty. That's like a real, real malty IPA.
Sure.
So, yeah. So I guess what that means, what that says to me is that they haven't really, I like their beers, you know, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
You should preface this statement with everything that they make is great. But then you again, you and I are not necessarily like your typical new craft beer drinker, like somebody that's come into the industry to be a consumer in the past 8 years, right? Sure. So big bottles of Imperial Stouts, that went away. That was a thing.
Yep.
About 8 years ago, right? And even longer ago than that. That's when they were really hitting their stride. And malty IPAs. And they just like never really, I didn't see any big moves where they pivoted well, right? As opposed to another local example, it's because we got, but Odell, for example, like I feel like they've made, maybe it's just a matter of they made a choice on taking a new brand or brand refresh in terms of like a style of beer or just the logos and stuff. And it just happened to work. Sometimes it's just luck. I remember when we were working, when I was working at Sierra, and you'd hear conversations from distributors about like, you know, we'd launched three new brands in the past 3 years. You know, a lot of times these bigger breweries, they'll release a new beer every year that's going to be like their next big hit, hopefully.
Sure.
And it was Sidecar Orange Pale Ale, when that was a thing.
I remember that beer.
Yeah, not a lot of people do, for good reason. And then there's Tropical Torpedo. Do you remember that one?
No.
Okay, Tropical Torpedo was essentially when Sculpin was hot. And they would use Sculpin,
I remember Torpedo, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense now.
So then they would just basically say, all right, well, now we have grapefruit sculpin, we have pineapple sculpin, we've got habanero sculpin. They wanted to do that with the Torpedo brand. Then that tanked. And then Otravace came out, and then that did okay, but Goza just hasn't proven to be a big hit on the national scale, and is still, to my knowledge, has to be one of the only beers that won a medal at the gold medal at the World Beer Cup, and then they changed the recipe 6 months later because they needed to try to make it more appealing to a mass market. So that one tanked. And then I remember distributors saying, you guys don't have that many like chances left to kind of earn the trust of the public and then earn our trust too. Like, how can we go in on some of these brands when they don't have a proven track record? And then Hazy Little Thing came out.
I was going to say, and then, That's interesting to me, because for all the reasons why that should have failed, it didn't. I feel like Little Hazy Thing came out after the hazy train really started. Which is usually a recipe for failure for a more established brand when you're a little late to the game to jump on a fad, or a trend rather. But for some reason, that worked out. Why do you think it did?
I'll say this real quick. I know that Jim Beam, we're not talking about brewing. We're talking about distilling, but Jim Beam, that is what they do. I know somebody who is in the R&D department at Jim Beam, and they had Jim Beam White ready to go. And they were waiting for all these other brands to release their clear whiskeys, their clear bourbons before they release theirs. So while it's definitely not a super aggressive sales tactic, but it's definitely done out there, and maybe more of a safe move. You have your sales are floundering because of kind of what you guys were just talking about. It's definitely, I've seen it out there in various industries.
Yeah. I mean, so some of these big brand launches, it's just a stroke of luck. It's where the industry happens to be at the time. It depends on, that's part of marketing. Marketing comes into play too. You just don't know what's going to catch the consumer's attention. And full circle to kind of bring this back around, what I don't know is did Great Divide have, because they weren't really available back when I was living in New York, so I've sure. only been here for 2 years. So I don't know a lot of their big entries into the market, but did they try to cash in on it, get a home run on some releases, and they just haven't paid off? Because you got to go ahead.
Oh no, I do think that they put a lot of stock behind their Denver Pale Ale revival, and they did a really killer job in terms of branding. Of they were working with different artists each year. It was their rotating artist series, where they would pick a local artist. They would be tasked to create the new label for Denver Pale Ale each year. And they had some really tremendous artists. A friend of mine, John Vogel, did one of my favorite labels that they've ever, exists in craft beer. And it was one of their Denver Pale Ale releases. But the problem was that it was still a Denver Pale Ale. And when Sierra Nevada Pale Ale has kind of cornered that market, and pale ales in general still haven't hit that big revival, then you're kind of stuck with putting a lot of your chips behind a brand that still hasn't kind of taken fire just yet. So
yeah, I mean, the pale ale market, unless it's hazy, has been tanking for years. That was the saving grace with Hazy Little Thing at Sierra, was that Sierra pale ale numbers were plummeting, Torpedo numbers were plummeting, and then they had 3 years in a row where every single time they swung the bat, they were going for a home run, and they wound up swinging and a miss. So that's like how you can't have too many of those in a row.
Sure.
For all of the forecasting that you've done to project out like new equipment, new space, new people, they had to have factored in projected sales for that facility at the time. And that's all based on new brands. It's based on distribution. So, and you look at I apologize for using local references, but it's what I got. And you think about the like two of the bigger breweries that are ahead of them, like even here in Colorado, right? So you've got New Belgium, and then you've got Oscar Blues, okay? Yeah. So they both had to take a more drastic approach in order to keep growing in terms of looking for investment capital. And New Belgium went to a full national footprint a couple of years ago to kind of inflate some of their sales numbers to make it more of a lucrative purchase for somebody looking to invest. And then Oscar Blues started Canarchy. So they were getting not only investment capital money, but then they're creating this like brewing conglomerate so they could continue to grow.
Yeah.
But they didn't just do it on their own, right? Like it took more than just them to kind of make that work. So I guess I'd love to hear more about what you think about a brewery that size and what they would need to do to either kind of take it to the next level or if it is better to scale back.
Well, I think you touched on it. You've got to approach it from a more innovative kind of standpoint. You know, we talk about Voodoo Brewery, who just recently announced their franchising model. You know, people are thinking outside of the box from the traditional, hey, you know, we're a regional brand, so let's just continue to grow because that's what we do. That doesn't cut it anymore. And so, you know, I think that's where you have to get creative. And I think you brought up a really great point in Oscar Blues. You know, as a brand itself, I've never thought that Oscar Blues has, you know, been on the forefront in terms of beer, aside from the fact that they were the first brewery to start canning. You know, I think the Oscar Blues Dale's Pale Ale, still an older kind of, you know, stuck in the past kind of brand. Mama's Little Yellow Pils, not a super crisp, not like the best kind of pilsner out there. You know, I haven't been super impressed with any of their core offerings. And I don't think that they've also done a really great job in kind of refreshing. But when you bring in these other players with Cigar City and Perrin and, you know, like continuing to grow this conglomerate, that's where you remain relevant. That's where you can continue to diversify kind of your approach towards business.
Yeah, it's hard for some of these old brands, man, because their line of logic is this got us here in the first place, right? Sure. When I was at Harpoon, they would talk to us in sales meetings about, they take the what they call the armadillo strategy. So when things start to get a little hectic, they'll curl up and protect themselves rather than kind of start swinging and fight the fight. So in their minds, I hate to say it, theirs and some of these other older, bigger brewers, they're like, it's a fad. You know, this isn't going to last,
sure,
kind of thing. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Kind of transitioning from that real quick. I know that we don't have a ton of time left, but I do want to touch on two kind of bigger breaking kind of things that have transpired in the last day or so. First and foremost, you know, talking about these older brands, regional brands that have, you know, are kind of in jeopardy right now. I continue to hear kind of concerns around Avery. And, you know, today we found out that Andy Parker, the long time, I think he was there for 15 years as their barrel manager, is leaving Avery to join Denver Beer Company. And I can't speak as to, this is kind of some insider rumblings that I had heard, that at one point the barrel program at Avery had consisted of over 4,000 barrels. And I think as of the last that I heard, it had been scaled down to only around 400. And so that's a true signal. And again, I can't go completely on the record on that one, but I think there were estimates of you know, such an incremental decrease in barrelage of barrel-aged beers in their barrel program. And you know, that would be a concern to someone like their barrel manager. And so mm-hmm. Denver Beer Company continues to make the right moves. You know, of course, you know, we don't want to neglect the tragedy that happened when Jason Buehler, their head brewer over there, passed away this summer. But as a business standpoint, I feel like they're continuing to grow and make some of the smartest decisions for an emerging craft brewery in Colorado, where, you know, when they first started, you know, I got to admit, I had kind of written them off because their beer wasn't the greatest, but I think that they've continued to iterate. They continue to tweak their recipes, continue to hire the right people. And now they're about to open, I believe, another brand new facility out near Platt Park that I think is going to kill it. So really, really huge news for Andy Parker to move from Avery over to Denver Beer Company.
Yeah, I mean, hey, from the perspective of the owners, like down at DBC, it's like, you don't always have to be the best at what you do. You need to hire the people that are really good at what they do, yep. Right? So taking some of the ego out of it and just bringing on really great people that are awesome at doing particular things really, really well. And I didn't necessarily even know that they had a pretty well meddled and well-regarded barrel program already. So
yep.
Bringing somebody like this on board is going to only improve things and make it better. And you got to figure from his standpoint, It's probably going to be a lot more fun. I mean, when Avery got purchased however long ago, Sapporo money, right? Isn't that where it came in?
No, they were oh shoot, I'm drawing a blank.
I could have sworn it was Sapporo.
No, that they were,
was it the San Miguel?
And then
the
founders. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that. I think it might have been both of them. But anyway, so I mean, hey, when you get investment capital money or big brewer money, then they want to start seeing the bottom line a little bit more, and it becomes less of an art and more of a business.
And similar situation, like I said before, they invested in a multi-million dollar facility and just, you know, didn't grow into it in the same trajectory that they had kind of forecasted beforehand. So
yeah. And sometimes those parts of the industry start to fade, you know, like we discussed earlier, you know, big Imperial stouts and 22 ounce bottles, 24 ounce bombers or whatever were huge 10 years ago. And yep. You didn't necessarily think there was reason to change. So you totally. Make investment in towards where you think the industry is going. And sometimes you make the wrong move and the investment went to the wrong place.
Yeah. And Jonathan Shikes, who's thankfully tuning in. Thanks, John. He just checked us on that. The name is Mal San Miguel. So, thank you for that fact checked.
Thank you, Shikes.
What up, Shikes? And then the one kind of big piece of news that I think hasn't been reported yet that we're unfortunately really bummed about, but it looks like Stout Month will not be happening at Mountain Sun Breweries this year. You know, they for the longest time, they kind of helped establish this kind of iconic industry cult following in Stout Month every February. Over the years, they had built the program out to a full tap takeover with you know, over like 30 or 40 stouts each month that consists mostly of in-house, but also over the recent years, tons of collabs and featuring guest taps from local breweries and also national breweries. Unfortunately, due to the pandemic, the brewing operations haven't been taking place dating back to November. And so it's looking like Stout Month is not going to be happening at Mountain Sun this year, but they are hoping to reopen in a big way once things are kind of safer for operations. You know, it's tough when a brewery can only operate at 25%. It's not necessarily the best business decision to reopen for full service. So I totally, my heart goes out to the Mountain Sun family. It's really difficult right now. And on that point, you know, it's a reminder, if you've got the means to do so, please go out and support your local breweries. Now's the time to continue to buy to-go beers, participate in dry hopped January instead of dry January, and drink more beer.
Yeah. I mean, it's that time of year that you want to enjoy stouts anyway. I know we've been bashing 24 ounce stouts for most of the show, but you can still get 12 ounce cans, you get 16 ounce cans, crowlers. I mean, I was always a sucker for like Sierra Narwhal. Brooklyn Black Ops was one that I always used to look forward to every year. Obviously the distribution on that kind of wilted, but I think they're trying to re-merge the brand a little bit. I've seen some Instagram posts about it. And then even locally here, I love the Epic Big Bad Baptist series. You know, they do so many different variants. The stout for being like heavier and higher ABV is still like thin enough to drink, but it's not like watery thin. It's a really great mix. So yeah, go out and support some of your local breweries, drink some stouts. Get that liquid sweater going. It's that time of year.
Yeah, totally. All right.
Well, this is going to be haunted by the ghost of Dale Catechus now for talking shit about Oscar Blues.
Whatever. If he wants to come on the show, we'll talk to him.
Yeah. Well, guys, I think that's about it for now. Really, really killer episode. We didn't get to touch on all of our points. You know, one of the notable ones was that Sweetwater has begun distribution out here in Colorado. So that's exciting news for anyone from the Southeast. But yeah, really, really lots of great information, really great takes from Corey. And thank you, Bryant, for being on the ones and twos over there and making sure we sound great. And hopefully Sammy can join us for our next episode. Once again, we are gonna be broadcasting every other week, pretty much around this time. I believe we're gonna shoot for every other Tuesday, but just stay tuned. We'll have some episodes coming up with some big announcements from Julia Herz. And then also more guests to be named here shortly. Before we go, I do want to give one more plug to our sponsor. A big thank you to our friends over at Molly Spirits. For all of our Denver listeners or anyone visiting Denver, explore a land of adult beverage discovery at Molly Spirits, offering a curated selection of beers, wines, and spirits in Lakeside and Greenwood Village, Colorado. Shop over 14,000 products, including exclusive collabs and an extensive craft beer selection, in-store or online for curbside pickup or delivery. Learn more at mollyspirits.com. on that note, we are going to be bringing on a new sponsor here very shortly. So be on the lookout for that. But for anyone else who's listening, if you are interested in sponsoring the show, we're always open to new sponsors. So
Oscar Blues just pulled out. They're not interested anymore.
Oscar Blues and Yuengling are no longer in consideration, apparently.
I mean, we can be convinced, but it's going to take a lot. So
no, but hit us up if you're interested in sponsoring the show. We'd love to have you on, and we can, you know, have you on as a guest as well. And also for everyone tuning in, be sure to follow us on all of your listening devices, whether that's iTunes, Apple, Apple Play, or Stitcher. Yeah, hit us up, follow us, give us a like, and yeah, we'll check you later. This has been episode 4 of the Porchcast.